probably a certain amount of collaboration that other people have indicated. I can't believe my interpretations are unique.
No, it's just that if there are judgments, one likes them corroborated by a number of people.
Yes.
If there are disagreements, one likes to be able to check them. And so, either way, some of them were, it was the first time I'd heard them. I don't know that they're unique, but...
It would be interesting to get Irv Shane's analysis at some point in time.
Yes, he has said that he will do an interview. He's going to be coming back to campus occasionally. but Art Hovey has suggested waiting until he's worked his way into his present job.
Yes, I think, and it's also good to be away from it for a period of time. I think you get a little different perspective on it, and you aren't as quite as harsh. And he was involved, and as I indicated, he is. Was one of the outstanding administrators. If it wouldn't have been for Irv Shane, Ed Young would not have been a very good chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Young continually, and this we're not as on the tape. It's not on the tape, I hope, right now.
Well, yes.
Right now it is.
Yes, but that's fine. I mean, this is a. This is a research document, and it's not going to be publicized.
Yes.
And you're restricting it, so it's all right.
Ed Young always had difficulty, even with for a period of time, I believe, Irv moved out to Seattle, I believe, didn't he, for a while, went out of the University of Washington. Then he was brought back to take the chancellorship. And the system administration had great difficulty with Chancellor Young at that time in getting decisions out of the campus. And we consequently, decisions were made at times in system administration, particularly I would say by Percy, who was eager to make decisions. He was a quick one,
mm-hmm.
made them almost on impulse, which I think at times would have been better off if you give some time to mm-hmm. some of them. But he would move right in.
Have you got any examples? Of
that? Well, there was a lot, of course, with the medical center. And at the time, I believe that Ed Young was there. I can't remember who the vice chancellor, one of the medical of the center was at that time, but he's the one that came from out east and he went out.
Cook.
Mm-hmm. Under Cook, there was a lot of problems. And in making decisions. And Ed would make them, and then they'd bubble up here into system administration because they were building a $100 million project out there. And, I remember a lot about the Center for Health Sciences at that time.
He wouldn't make them, you mean he wouldn't have gotten around to making
them?
Well,
he just kind of believed in decisions by consensus
mm-hmm.
and not... a group of people. Ed did. Although when he was, Ed Young was president, he's, as I mentioned earlier, he's the one that made the decisions on maintaining low fees,
mm-hmm.
which I think hurt Madison more than it hurt the other campuses because their fees were higher.
I understand.
And their costs were higher.
That isn't set by the legislature. The percentage of the fees.
The final decision is always made by the legislature, but the policy of trying to hold down the fee increases and getting more tax money was a conscious one made by the president and was supported by the regents at that
mm-hmm.
time.
I'm going to be interviewing Lawton. I can ask him about that.
Yes, I think it was a mistake, and as I indicated earlier, the amount of money that students spend on fees is small compared to the other costs of going, particularly for resident students. And we're talking residents here, not non-residents. Yeah. For resident students, it's small. And it's something with all the financial aids we have now and so forth, it would have been in the system's best interest to go along with some fee increases at the appropriate time. Now, in the present administration, they have already proposed substantial fee increases. That is a mistake to do that at the initiation of the budget process. That should be something which is negotiated towards the tail end, because normally what happens is the legislature takes that money right away. And you don't get the program benefits that will come if you would say you want some of these things but would be willing to increase the fees to cover them. Mm-hmm. And as I indicated, Gene McPhee was always a believer in that. He would not propose initially when he was director of the state universities, but he would at the end for both salary adjustments as well as for program improvements. And it worked very successfully.
This must be known by experience. Why at this stage would they introduce it at the wrong time?
Well, remember, we have a new president again, and he's not had the experience of in Wisconsin.
Don't the staff know, or the regents?
I'm not so sure that they would. No, that's something. They don't. The person in system administration who would know most about this would be Wally Lemon, and he's not involved in that budget process.
Who is?
Well, it's the person who replaced Gene Arne, and it was the president, and I presume working with the chancellors. Mm-hmm. Now, let me say, it could work out all right. But the chances are that it will not. They won't get the full benefit that they would get if they come along with that policy recommendation later on in the process. You're following me, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's some of the techniques in negotiation.
I would like your comment on a statement of how funds were allocated in the system, that funds that came to Madison as part of the enrollment funding formula ended up being used for other institutions in the system.
I have never seen that happen outwardly. I can't give any examples of that occurring. I don't believe it would have been allowed by the Madison campus to be handled in that manner. Generally, the monies that were generated by a campus went back to the campus, which generated the fees. Mm-hmm. That was something that was watched very closely by the Madison campus, and I can't believe that actually took place. I know that before merger, that certainly would not have taken place between Madison and Milwaukee.
Actually, money that came to Madison was going to build up those institutions.
I think that may have been more perception than actual. I just don't believe that there was a lot of money moved around in that manner. My experience is Madison campus watched that very closely and was very much aware of the monies they were generating. I've indicated to you that during Ed Young's tenure as president, where there was unallocated money which he would just, without regent knowledge or anybody else's knowledge, had allocated to Madison and Milwaukee. We're talking about $500,000, and gave 300, I think the figure was 300,000 to Madison, 200,000 to Milwaukee, of money which was left over. Mm-hmm. I don't see any of those chancellors doing that. I mean, any of those presidents doing that, that I If it was minor amounts. It's nothing that, it wouldn't have been amount which would have made a significant difference.
I'm not sure it's an actual transfer of funds, and perhaps an example would be the statement I read that since Centers, or maybe did you say this? Since Centers system, the Center students didn't have to pay room and board, but paid the same tuition fees as students.
No, I didn't say somebody else did that, I think.
That in fact, what was happening was that students in Madison and other institutions were supporting the Center system students, in effect.
Well, what's going to be, as I remember, and have you interviewed Don Percy? You haven't yet.
Well, he's been interviewed, but not on specific matters like this, and it may be a good idea to go back to him.
I think it would. He was very instrumental up until the time that he left his administration when Dreyfus was governor in allocating the monies. I know that in the areas that I operated, and I had a lot to do with the facilities end, which also got involved in a lot of money for repairs and maintenance of the facilities. I always thought that Madison got more than it, if you would say and look at a student basis, they would have gotten more because they had buildings which were much older. We're talking about substantial amounts of money, which were renovations of the exteriors of buildings, Science Hall, for example. You can go on up the hill, take a look at Music Hall. You just go up and look. Well, look at it has been done. And some of it we thought should have been more insistent because I mentioned earlier that problems with the Home Economics Building, where they had, I think, a very weak dean who just didn't know how to do it. And I think the campus chancellor may have even not been too agreeable to pushing a project because it probably would not have been remodeled in the way that it probably should have been under a new dean.
This you're talking about the Madison Home Economics
Program. Yeah, Madison Home Economics. So sometimes they would hold money back, I think hold projects back because the project wasn't very well set up and it would be better if they wait.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned earlier that was true in the engineering school where they didn't push Bollinger, I believe, let more students in than he should have and wasn't doing things. And the projects just didn't sit. They weren't well thought out projects. Mm-hmm. The business school. Now, if you notice in the last capital budget, there are two projects which are in there. There's a big project for the engineering school, a big project for the business school, which I think was a long time and long overdue. I happen to be a graduate of the business school, but that also really didn't affect it.
Do you remember O'Neill's year 2000 plan for Milwaukee?
Yeah. I thought it was a little bit out, too much.
It looked rather so to me.
He was trying to help Milwaukee in getting more state support for, particularly for facilities and programs. I really was not overly impressed with Horton, who was chancellor there and now is president of Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma. He reached out a long ways, but he didn't seem to have the finesse. He was kind of like a bull in a china closet.
Mm.
He didn't care who he rolled over. And the projects that he came up with did not seem to be the kind which would bring about strength to an institution. We had the geography geological sciences, I guess they call it, was one of the big projects. And just millions of dollars were going to go into that. And we thought that there were areas which where there'd be more students involved in the programs which should have been supported. We're looking at it from the facility end and how the facilities related to enrollment and so forth. And we went, spent, oh, just 6 months to a year, and the vice president for academic affairs was right along with us. We didn't in facilities management end of it and capital budgeting make the decisions. We relied on our academic people. They reviewed every project and they had to recommend to us. And the person that was reviewing the project was Dallas Peterson, whose area is geography, or if that's the science that they call it now. And he was very disappointed what they were proposing. It really didn't impact many students, and it was a $15 to $17 million, and it got to $20 million, and so forth. We thought there were other areas that would have been more a better utilization of the money. But that's all part of that 2000 plan, and I don't feel that state of Wisconsin can support two institutions the type of Madison. And Milwaukee was always trying to be like Madison, mm-hmm. and instead of doing its own thing and developing its own strengths. They wanted to be supported the same way. As I indicated to you earlier, and I was kind of surprised that you didn't know about it, is that the quality of students is not the same as Madison's.
Well, no, I knew about it. It's just, you know, one gets it as hearsay. So that's again a view that is interesting.
I wish I had kept the document, which showed that, but I. But they don't leave that information out because it's something that you don't want the public to really know about. You know, one information school gets all the poor students, yeah. Another one gets all the best students. But it's known within the system that where the quality students are. And the high schools know that, as I indicated to you. It's awfully hard for Milwaukee to recruit quality students. It's an urban campus, and it's difficult in those areas. It isn't like a Columbia, which has established itself, and Milwaukee never has, I don't think, established itself yet.
It's very interesting. When I interviewed O'Neill, I was asking him towards the end questions about Madison, and every time I asked him a question about Madison, he answered about Milwaukee. And then I came across this the discussion of the year 2000 plan on the regions, and realized he must have very much espoused the cause of Milwaukee.
Yeah, well, he brought Horton in. He hired Horton.
Oh, he did?
Yes, he hired Horton.
I see. Because was it Horton? I heard it said that the chancellor before the present one fought opposed Madison and would
Werner Baum.
Yeah.
Who was
Oh, that's Baum, is it?
Baum, Werner Baum. See, Werner Baum followed Clatchy.
Uh-huh.
And he was a very conservative one, again, who was hired in the Weaver administration, mm-hmm. by the Weaver, and really was a very more of a Republican type, a conservative person, and I don't think ever fit in the saddle in Milwaukee very well. He wasn't a very astute administrator, in my opinion. He didn't do a lot for Milwaukee.
Well, would he have, undercut's not the word, what is the word I want? Always pushing to get Milwaukee interests ahead of Madison, whereas I think maybe it was Don Smith who said that the two of them could have cooperated.
Yes. I think that's true.
And that the present chancellor is more co- cooperative.
The one that is right now?
Yes.
Or speaking of
well,
Horton?
Well, now I'm not sure.
See, Horton just left, so you were interviewing Don Smith, and you didn't do that within the last year, did you?
Yes.
You did?
Mm. And it may not even be Don Smith who said it. But the point is, what's your view? Because you.
Pardon?
The point is, what is your view about it?
Well, I would. Werner Baum was not an effective chancellor. He was out of tune with the liberal and, well, the Democrats, which are made up, come generally from Milwaukee. There are maybe a few in the suburbs, which are Republicans, but most of them are Democrats. And I think he was out of tune and out of touch. He was a Weaver appointee, and I would say is largely ineffective as a chancellor.
And how about it,
how about Horton?
Yeah.
Well, I think Horton was more effective. He did a lot of things and moved a lot of things forward. He worked fairly well with Shane. I don't know if Shane, but Horton wasn't Shane's type of person. Horton was came on with wild statements and so forth, which to me were kind of out of place. I never was overly impressed with him. I believe that the current chancellor is a better person, although I don't personally know him. From what I hear about him, he's going to be more effective. One of the things that you always rate chancellors on is the quality of people that they surround themselves with. Mm-hmm. Werner Baum did not surround himself with good people, and I don't think Horton surrounded himself with good people. The person I dealt with over there, I just couldn't stand. He just was obnoxious and so forth. A fellow named Don Melkus. He just was not an effective person. And I think he hurt them more than helped them. He didn't know how to work effectively with a system administration. And he'd want to go around this all the time. And that's not very effective unless you know what you're doing and you're not in concert. You got to be able to work with them to get them to think the way you want to think in system administration. That's the job of the chancellor. And you can't fight them because they can do so many things to hurt you. But they can do so many more things to help you in getting things. Horton was not well-liked among his colleagues.
You mean his fellow chancellors?
Fellow chancellors. He was not well-liked.
Because he was like,
well, his personality and so forth.
Was he offensive?
Yeah, he'd make stupid statements. He almost seemed like a little kid once in a while, like a kid who wouldn't get his way, he'd pout. And he wasn't the quality of a Shane. It was far from that.
This would be at chancellor's meetings.
Yes, at chancellor's meetings or at building commission meetings or regents meetings and so forth. But as I indicated, certainly Herb Shane surrounded himself with good people. And I always thought, in the areas that I operated, that they got their fair share. As I said, when O'Neill was president, Shane made a point of it. He wanted to come and negotiate with me personally. And I would even go to the extent of showing him our priority list. Mm-hmm. And without any other chancellors and so forth involved, mainly because they had so many projects. And it was always a problem of fitting those in. And then he would kind of give some of his insight in that. And we would change things around to adjust. While the legislature followed the priority list, they did pick and choose up and down the list, depending on the the school involved, or the college involved. As I indicated earlier, the College of Ag was just was the best political college to deal with. They just knew how to get things done.
Did the legislature ever regard priorities in terms of the different campuses? Did they favor or not favor the Madison campus? I mean, if they changed priorities.
I didn't see that. No, I didn't see that. There were times, depending on the makeup of the commission, and I didn't sense that. You see, they make the building commission really reacts to the governor's recommendations, and the governor is the key person. The building commission just makes minor changes from what the governor recommends. So the governor is the key person in that, and I didn't see them favoring one campus necessarily over the other. I've dealt with Governor Earl on physical education buildings, which were really a problem for us. We had so many needs in that area, and most people didn't look at it as a educational program, whereas we looked at it more as combining recreation, not so popular now in health.
Physical education?
Well, not physical education, but it's the ongoing keeping yourself healthy, developing a lifetime of care for yourself, and lifetime sports and so forth. Mm-hmm. That goes hand in hand with a person's, you know, well-being.
Yeah. I'm going to have to say.
You'll find that Irv Shane was strongly believed that, and so did Ed Young when he was chancellor. There's a, I think, a much higher priority to that. And I always believe that students would have been and are willing to pay fees, additional fees, for facilities for that purpose. I think it was probably a mistake to go all with tax dollars. I've been in many meetings, not many, but a number of them, where students have come to me and said, well, we'd be willing to.
Yeah.
The students are willing to raise fees just for that purpose, to build the facilities. Their students are more conscious of this, and I think it's good. Mm-hmm. They're going to live longer for that, too.
Sure. Well, I wanted to ask you about some things I've come across in looking through the Regents' minutes. You didn't have anything to do with the composite support index.
No, that was a product initially of Percy and Kamek. That was Percy's big thing. He was strongly supportive of that, and that, of course, supporting students based on the curriculum, the programs that were being offered in the enrollments and so forth.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated thing to keep track of. I don't know how.
Well, that's all right.
No, I was never involved in that. So. I can't really recall much anymore about John Weaver's wife. You have to be refreshed on it. When they first started, when the merger, the president of the system was residing in, I think it's Olenhaus, the one where...
Up in the University Heights.
University Heights. When Ed Young became... Well, and John Weaver was... great entertainer. And he had something which people got tired of after a while. And generally he'd get up and talk, and he's such a long-winded talker. He kind of started shifting in their chairs after a while. I don't recall his wife being a particular problem, because at that time Madison Campus took care of everything. But when they shifted out to the Brittingham House and system administration, we got more involved with the operation out there, because it's somewhat separate, and we kind of thought it should be somewhat separate from the Madison campus. That they, although they still continue to do a lot of the work out there. Karen O'Neill was a very gracious person, I thought. I found her very good to work. We would hire her help. She would make the selection, but then we would take care of the responsibility of firing them. Because that's, I think, what we should do. I don't think a president's wife should have to get involved in that. Socially, she was very effective, I thought. She did a pretty good job. Ed Young's wife really didn't have great impact. She was not a very social person. And Ed Young did not have as many meetings out there, gatherings. And I think that's one of the things that I was disappointed with, that the president of the system felt it his responsibility to entertain these regents every Thursday night. Whereas I thought they would have been probably just as effective if they could have gone on their own and been downtown working with the legislators and so forth.
You mean while they were here in Madison?
Yes, while they were here in Madison. Yeah. That was a change when under State University, under McPhee's administration, they never had those gatherings, maybe one or two a year. At most. They generally, when they went to visit a campus, they would have them. But when they were met in Madison, they were on their own, and they did a lot of politicking downtown. And these regents were all political people. And I think they lost some benefit by having social gatherings. And you're always together with the same group of people.
Yeah.
You got to know the regents somewhat better.
Were you in on those meetings?
Know, my wife at the end just could not stand them anymore, so I could never get her to go. A lot of the wives did not go, because it was always the same thing, and it got awful tiresome. Sometimes I would bow out. I wouldn't just show up, but because you meet with them all day, and then you'd see them at night, and then you see them the next morning again.
Yeah,
that's an awful lot of time. I just assumed be away from them. I don't see much of an impact in system. Karen O'Neill did have. I know appointed as one person, which strictly because of her that the person was around.
Who was that?
It was somebody, isn't it Madison Kipp out here? She's a tall person, and I can't remember who she was. She was involved in some special programs, but she was really a friend of Karen's and O'Neill. Since I've heard since Shaw has been president that Mrs. Shaw got kind of involved in getting his office.
In what?
In getting his office set up and picked out the grapes and so forth. Mm. But that's no particular problem. You kind of expect some of that. I don't, well, that sort of thing is, you know, that's no problem.
No.
But he's, I noticed, I guess they're still continuing to have the Thursday night gatherings out at the house. As I said, I got the impression that some of the regents would have just as soon not gotten involved continuing in that. Would have been, and some of them deliberately did not go to him. For example, I know that Knowles and Fish would go to their hotel room and that was what they were, used to play cards together quite often. They enjoyed that sort of relationship.
Yes, a little bit of relaxation you'd need.
Yes. Yeah, these formal affairs, you know, never are very relaxing.
You started this off by saying the impact of faculty wives. I thought you were going to say something else, but
no, I don't think that. I have not seen much of an impact policy-wise from the faculty wives.
I meant presidents-wise.
Presidents-wise, yeah, I have not seen that.
Administrators-wise, yeah.
I think.
Chancellors-wise.
It's not really a major impact on their success or failure. I have not noticed that over the years. There's some wives that of chancellors that have been very effective. Leonard Haas's wife was just marvelous.
Well, it must have here. It must have meant some stepping on toes of the Madison chancellor, I should think. Some because of.
Yes, I always thought that the chancellor at Madison campus should be entertaining the regents periodically. And that would have been, not every time, but at least once a year.
But he wasn't allowed to, or?
Well, because he was kind of dominated by the president. They made quite a thing on football games. Mm-hmm. Well, that varied with chancellors. O'Neill attempted to do quite a bit in that area in his early years. I don't think he did as much at the end of it. Ed Young didn't do as much. He didn't feel that that was appropriate, but he would attempt to get him out to the Olin House once in a while. Irv Shane was not a very social person. Mm-hmm. He didn't do very much along that line, and I don't think it had a lot to do with the effectiveness of a chancellor, what he did or didn't do socially. It's what he did administratively on campus which determined really his success. And the words get back to, you know, presidents, the regents become aware who's more effective and who's more ineffective. Yeah. We see that many times. I always made a point of, in meetings, of getting chancellors involved. When projects were up, Irv Shane was generally around. And he knew that he was expected to provide the leadership and support of his project as well as the other chancellors. We just told him that you got to be there. Mm-hmm. Regents like to hear the chancellor speak. At meetings, regents meetings, the Madison chancellor spoke more than anybody else. That was certainly my impression. And the Madison chancellor tended to be a vocal person, particularly Shane was, and very effective with regents. I guess I'm kind of repeating myself.
Well, I'm glad we added that little appendix. This is tape 4 of the interview with Robert Winter. Make sure it's 4 and not 5. It's 4. let's What about, came across a little discussion of collection of accounts, which Ruben Lorenz, and is this anything of any importance?
I don't think, if you're talking about fees that weren't paid, or...
I don't, maybe it isn't anything at all.
It's not an important, it would not have had a what I would consider a significant impact. It was probably more minor in nature.
Yeah, okay. Do you know anything about the appointment of the academic vice president under Young?
Wasn't that Leonard Haas?
Well, he may have filled in temporarily, but there was a search and screen committee.
No, I was not involved in that.
I guess the next question is, do you know why Ed Young left when he did?
I mentioned that he was out of favor with Lee Dreyfus because he and Don Smith were, because of some of their, what I think was required by the regents of making it somewhat difficult for him to get a leave and so forth to run for governor. And it was, I think I am on record of indicating that Lee Dreyfus was very displeased and would have nothing to do with either one of those people. They were not welcomed in the Capitol.
Well, could Dreyfus make Young resign?
No, but it was very obvious that he wasn't welcome, and he did that on his own, I'm sure. He was not, the governor didn't do that. The governor made it known that he was not welcome. At that time, Burke Grover was president of the board, and as I think I previously indicated, he and I did. We had a lot of the contacts downtown. We're the only ones that were really welcomed from system administration at that time, particularly at the upper levels. They were persona non grata down there.
Yeah.
So he had no other choice. His choice was very much the same as when Weaver resigned. He was not particularly welcomed by Percy, by Lucy. He was not liked by Lucy.
But he stayed on until 77.
Wait a minute, he didn't stay on that long. He left in 74, 75. See, the merger took place in 72, and he stayed on another 2 years, but no longer than that. Then for an interim, they had an interim president, I believe. Somebody took over for a short period of time there, in between. But you must remember, he was, at that time, there was a very conservative board appointed by, not conservative, but it was appointed Republican board.
Yes.
And that gradually changed with Lucy's new appointees. Mm-hmm. And it took some time before those new appointees became a majority. And when they once became a majority, then they made it known.
So that's why Weaver left.
That's right. But you notice that there was in some of the meetings, if you look carefully, in the board meeting of 1/12/73, President Weaver made statement referencing relations with governor. With governor, criticism executive committee to make in-depth examination of his stewardship and their pleasure in his continued service.
Mm-hmm.
He resigned in advance of Ed Young being appointed. So they had a great difficulty in finding a person that the board would agree to accept that position. And Ed Young was kind of a compromise candidate at the end.
Hmm.
He wasn't their first choice. he kind of backed into that position rather than, I don't think he really wanted it, per se. He was kind of had to be talked into it. I think he'd have preferred to stay on the Madison campus, but that, I have no way, that's the perception I had.
That they couldn't agree on anybody. It wasn't that they couldn't get somebody who'd accept.
They weren't accepting the position. They didn't want the position. Any of the outstanding candidates, as I understand it, turned down the position. Those were not easy times in system administration, yeah. Nor was it in the system and in the campuses. Because of that turmoil among the regents.
Which went on until when?
Well, I think it settled down when they got O'Neill, it settled down. I think he provided more effective leadership for a period of time. And then he got involved in that salary issue, which virtually tore him apart on the faculty salaries, where he gave Madison and I don't recall what he gave Milwaukee substantially more money, and pushed that through. There's still an aftermath of that going on today, and you can see it. I think they could have done the same thing by increasing fees earlier, and it would have been accomplished without it, all of the hullabaloo that they have.
You don't think it was possibly because, you spoke about Arthur de Bartolabin last time. When I looked through the minutes in the late 70s, he's very vocal, and let's see, and Beckwith.
Yes.
And Joyce Erdman. I just wondered if you said the board settled down when O'Neill came. It was O'Neill and not the members. Of course, de Bartolabin was still there.
Yes, I think O'Neill it came. Settled down more, though. O'Neill did provide some good leadership. He was very articulate, but I never considered him to be an outstanding president. He certainly wasn't. Well, we haven't had, I would say, outstanding leadership. Don't you gather that from your conversation with people?
Oh, yes. No, I'm trying to get back to the board of regents in your statement that they were at loggerheads.
Well, when they were loggerheads between, fairly evenly split between the Dreyfus appointees and the Lucy appointees. And Lucy, I don't think, pointed as quality of people as Dreyfus appointed. I think Dreyfus appointees were stronger people. And I think Earl made good appointments.
Whom would you single out as Dreyfus appointees that were strong?
I've got to go back to them.
Well, I can give you a list.
That would be...
Would you...
Well, the excellent appointments that... Dreyfus made were Fish, Russell O'Harrell. See, the next time he made Robert Knowles, very solid person, very good supporter of higher education over the years. As I mentioned previously, Veneman, who was strong politically. I mentioned O'Harrell. Then he brought Frank Heckrod in. Paul Schilling never really, I don't think, had the impact. He was relatively young. He was quite conservative.
How do you define a strong appointment?
Well, I think the political impact they have, there's no question that Lawton was an exceptional regent and just an excellent person and strong supporter of higher education and had impact. see, Lawton's, I think it's kind of born in the family. There's John Lawton, who has been a lobbyist here for years and years, and I believe is an older brother to Ben Lawton. He was just good, and he was president for quite a number of years there, and very handled things very fairly. Always found him to be excellent to deal with, to work with. Although I primarily worked with the committee chairman that you're assigned to. You spend most of your time with that person. As I mentioned, O'Hara was just an outstanding, Russ O'Hara from Kano Falls, or he's a farmer from up there.
Well, what made him outstanding?
He just knew how to operate. Now, he had an ag background, and he was very close to the ag school here. And he had worked extensively with legislative matters in the farm operations. You know, they worked through a lot of committees, and they know how to get things done from the grassroots and know how to relate to people. Archie Bartleton was very vocal, and you'll hear him all the time. And if you read minutes, you'll always see that he's in. But I don't consider him to be a very effective. People didn't like him. There were Democrats on the board, for example, Frank Nicolay, who was an excellent appointee of Earl's in, I don't know when he was appointed, in 82 or 83. He's from Abbotsford, I believe, and he just would just detest having to deal with Arthur in the courtroom because he was just cantankerous, yeah. and you know, very offensive. He particularly didn't like people from the state university system.
Well, that's what I wondered about, because the only person you see in the Board of Regents, Beckwith sometimes, who really stands up for UW-Madison is DeBartoli.
Yes.
And who singles it out. It's
oh, yes.
Strange to me how rarely it's mentioned that it is important to keep UW-Madison going.
Yeah, well, but I don't think that should be interpreted as meaning there wasn't strong support for Madison.
No, I don't say that.
There was always an understanding that in the areas that I operated, that Madison get its fair share. As I indicated previously, some of the problems were on the Madison campus with weaknesses in certain leadership in schools. And when that occurs, the chancellor will tend to be somewhat slow in moving that school ahead because they probably wouldn't do the right thing. Merger, I think, was helped considerably. Merger helped considerably in getting fringe benefits and so forth improved. And if you notice, there's a lot of work there.
Yeah, you did talk about that.
And Madison really was instrumental in that. It was started under Ed Young, based on my recommendation, and has resulted in substantial improvements of the retirement programs, the health programs, the whole area of tax-deferred annuities. And that has helped Madison probably more than the outlying campuses, because you have more higher salaried people on the Madison campus. I think it's generally known, well, inside, that any salary adjustment program brings more money into Madison than the other schools, because they are what you would call top-heavy. Mm-hmm. They have more people in the ranks of professor and associate professor, and the other ranks really aren't very much.
I read this statement somewhere yesterday that at some point Milwaukee had higher average salaries than Madison.
I don't believe that. I have never seen that. If that is the case, you're turning it off or on?
Oh. Why?
I see your window was open, that's why.
Yes, well, they sort of don't. Are you all right?
I'm fine. I dress for it.
Well, what I'm really interested in is just your statement that the Board of Regents was tied up in the end of the 70s because of conflicts. And what kind of decisions did this affect? Or didn't it?
Well, I think it did not have the impact with Lucy. That it probably could have had. I think it didn't. What didn't really affect Dreyfus' administration. Dreyfus, in spite of what everybody said, provided I think excellent salary adjustment programs, mm-hmm. and he understood that you get more money into the operating budget through salary adjustments than through anything else, mm-hmm. except when you start a new program up, then you get like that medicine here.
Yeah.
Brought a lot of money in here, and I think the Center for Health Sciences, when they moved out and new facilities, it really resulted in substantial improvements. A lot of that came from increased operating money, which came from the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and research money, because they had facilities to do research.
So, I'm trying to get back to that statement you made that it wasn't until O'Neill came that the board settled down. And
I think
whether this had an effect on how the system operated or.
Well, I think the board got more together under O'Neill than it had existed under both Weaver and Ed Young.
And would this have affected? Before O'Neill, would this have affected people in the system, or would it have affected
decisions?
Well, I think
the effectiveness was not there.
What suffered as a result?
I would say so, yes.
Well,
I think it primarily in the operating budget. I think they didn't get the resources.
They didn't fight hard enough.
Yes, and part of it was, as I indicated earlier, was their policy of maintaining low fees.
Uh-huh.
Both Weaver had that and Ed Young had that as a major policy.
Yeah.
And that cost them a lot of money, which they could have, a lot of program money. And it would not have affected the enrollment to any great deal because you had financial aid, the students in need would have gotten more money.
And no regent came up and said, "Look, we ought to raise fees."
No, there wasn't that support there. Well, because they generally followed the leadership of the president on that. The president, to some extent, I think O'Neill was partly, but also would have been better served if he'd have pushed the fee increases.
Yeah.
They rank low, you know, in comparison to a lot of other states and nationally. And as I said, that's one reason the state universities prior to merger did so well, because we were agreeable to increasing fees. Universities. I don't think he had a particular problem, although he was not a strong president in many respects. One of the problems, if you notice, that they've had, for example, Harrington in 1967 had a salary of $45,000. In 10 years, Ed Young was appointed. I noticed his salary in 1980, which is 13 years later, was $65,800. That's an increase of not quite 50%, but that's not that didn't represent the change in in the cost and they're just now, I think, increasing the salary to the levels that it should be to attract the kind of people that they need to operate.
Yeah.
They rapidly have increased it, and I don't know what Shaw is getting, but I think he's getting close to 100 now.
Yes, that's what I thought. So you think that Dreyfus more or less forced Ed Young to resign?
Well, he didn't force him to resign, but he just made it
so difficult.
And I'm sure that this word came back to the regents. And Ed Young knew he wasn't welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And neither was Don Smith welcome.
So
it was a very difficult period for... I was a personal friend of Grover.
Uh-huh.
I was instrumental in getting him from his position as superintendent in a small northern school district to Monona, which he, I later found out his real objective was to get a base to be elected to a superintendent of schools. And Pearl Grover was a very political person, and still is. He knew that Young and Smith were persona non grata.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question. That comes, you can just have a sense of feeling when the governor doesn't want to talk to you.
Mm.
And you get your influence as president assistant through the governor. You got to make a change. And Ed Young knew that. He's a very astute politician. He knew what the heck was going on. I always thought it was rather surprising that Dreyfus hired Percy to become head of health and social services. I never completely agreed with Percy's decision-making process. They were oftentimes made too quickly off the top of his head. You could ask him anything right away, you'd get a decision from him.
Mm.
In a system as large as this, you tend to move rather slowly. you don't make abrupt changes because it has such an impact. He had a lot of gimmicks.
So, and you think, you're surprised that Dreyfus...
I was surprised that Dreyfus had hired him, but he was impressed with Percy, and Harrington used him to some extent, but not the same extent that he didn't have the position with Harrington that he had with Weaver. Weaver really relied heavily on it. I'm on record mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. of indicating that. I never thought under Weaver and Percy and Smith that the Madison campus was shortchanged. I think that's a more of a myth, and was stated as a reason for Madison to get more money rather than based on fact is more myth. There may be in small amounts of money, but nothing which would have had a major impact on this campus, not the Madison campus. Milwaukee, I think, to some degree, split the support because it pushed so hard over there, and the Milwaukee delegation, particularly under Horton, Horton had organized the Milwaukee delegation pretty well,
mm-hmm.
which Werner Baum, who was there before, just could not do. He was Republican appointee and very conservative and really had no relationships to that Milwaukee legislative contingent.
Well, let's do a little more with O'Neill then. He had such a different style. When you start the regents' meetings, when O'Neill came, he would give long, long reports to the regents.
Yes. It's kind of surprising as you looked at it from looking back at it, how his stature seemed to slip as longer he stayed with them. stayed with the presidency. He had somewhat unorthodox method of operating. He really personally wanted to get involved in a lot of the little things which went on in the legislative process, and did a lot to go out and meet with legislators and so forth. But I got the impression he was not really as effective. He was a different kind of a personality. Have you interviewed him at all?
Yes.
He's a different kind of a person than the other presidents that we have. Very intelligent person, tremendous mind. But it's, you know, such things as, which to me as an administrator and so forth, that he would type all his own letters, then give them the secretary to retype. He'd sit in there, and his great thing was typing. We always could see he's either typing speeches or so forth. I think initially he was more effective, as I indicated, than he was as he continued on. And I got the impression that the regents felt likewise. The more that he continued on, the less effective. Now, part of the problem that he ran into, seemed to get involved directly in the Madison campus affairs more than he should. He would attend faculty meetings and so forth, which I didn't think was any place for a system president to go to a chancellor's of the Madison campus faculty meetings, and he would speak up at times. While he's a member of the faculty, I think he stays away from that. Shames area. But he tended to get involved a little bit more directly. I think I told you that we met every week with Irv Shaim.
He did.
Every week he'd meet with him for an hour or two, several hours. It was just a regular session that he would have.
Shaim would come up to Van Hise.
I think most of the time, I presume at times O'Neill went down there too, but I don't know. In my area, I always made it a point of going to Shane's office and meet with him there in his office, and he was running the meetings. Uh-huh. And I was commenting, and I think that's the way it should be. I didn't think it was my position to bring the chancellor of the Madison campus into into my office, you know, to get involved.
How did Young handle that?
I don't know. I think he had, of course, Ed Young had fingers going all throughout that campus, and I don't recall how Ed Young handled.
In that case, I imagine that Shaim would have been perfectly willing to go to Ed Young's office because of their former relationship.
That is correct. There was that professional relationship there before, but be interesting sometime when you talk to Irv, Chancellor Shaim, to see how he reacted to O'Neill.
Yes, that will be the major question, because that was the major problem.
It was kind of surprising that I did get the impression that O'Neill was more concerned about the Madison campus than he was the other campuses. The story goes, and I can't base it on fact. You may get this from some other people as well to collaborate this. That when O'Neill came, he thought more that he was head of the Madison campus,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Rather than it was a system. Now I think he knew it was a system, but he felt that he was more in charge of the Madison campus. That's the story that I heard. I heard a number of times that he'd have more to do with the Madison campus than he actually had the authority, you know, should have had. I've seen him call down Herb Shane, which on the issue already where he thought he got way out of line and he's on a...
Where he thought Shane got out of line?
Yeah, Shane out of line politically and... And you found I'm repeating myself now that the success of all of these top administrators is primarily based on who they surround themselves with rather than on their personal impact.
Yes, I guess one of O'Neill's appointees was Kaufman, is that right? Did Kaufman start under O'Neill?
Yes, for a period of time, yes.
What was his position, and how was he in administration?
Well, I found him to be good to deal with. I had no personal problems with Kaufman. He wasn't as effective administrator is some that they've had in that position. I always thought that Don Smith was a good vice president for academic affairs, and an executive vice president, as he turned out to be. I had great admiration for him. The only problem under Weaver is that Percy dominated it and kind of would get involved in Herb's area. In Don Smith's area. He's rather aggressive. You go to him with a question, he immediately had an answer, as I told you.
Yeah. Well, did you have anything to do with Joe Kaufman yourself?
Yes, but as I mentioned, over the years, I was operated quite a bit more independent.
Well, that went on, yeah.
And then the rest of the vice presidents, they used to have these policy group meetings every Monday, which they'd have 30 or 40 people in.
Even O'Neill.
O'Neill, too. And you have them all sit around, and nothing ever really got decided. Mm-hmm. It was more of a discussion group. It was interesting, when Shaw came, he took himself out of those meetings and went back to meeting with just the vice presidents, and he has the executive vice president meet with the staff, and instead of, I understand now, as you started out every week, now it's about every 2-3 weeks, and they're gradually being phased out. They were not a very effective tool to make any decisions.
So O'Neill wasn't really a very good, or I should say, what kind of an administrator was he?
I did not consider him to be as an effective administrator. Well, of course, as I indicated it over, I don't think we had the strong leadership after merger that existed before merger. And I'm sure you'll find that from anybody else who comes, stands back and looks at things. One person you may find important in the oral history that was floating in and out of here in administration was Leonard Haas. For a while he was the executive vice president and I think worked for a period of time under Young, and he may have worked under, I can't remember, if he worked before. I thought Ed Young brought him in for a period of time. I think he was there for a while for when O'Neill was there, but I can't remember this. He was chancellor of the Eau Claire campus from, I don't know if it was from 53 or 54 until he retired It was something like 20 years, and probably had as has as good a mind, probably as strong of an educational leader that you would find, has a good knowledge of what went on here. And you may, I think it would be well worth your time to see if you could get him down to interview him, if he'd be willing to it. Mm. He's very still very capable. He's now must be close to 70. But he was involved with assistant administration for at a number of intervals there. And it'd be interesting to see what his analysis. Mm. I know he would be quite careful in what he would say. He's a very honorable person, but a very astute and good administrator. He was probably the best higher educational administrator or president or chancellor that I had the opportunity of working with. Just an outstanding person, but has intimate knowledge in a lot of this. Yeah. These affairs here, and is responsible for developing that institution as a very strong educational institution.
How were O'Neill's relationships with the other chancellors besides Shane?
Oh, I think they're effective. I don't know if I would say that he. His appointments were all the best. He didn't do a very good job of researching the chancellor which replaced Leonard Haas at Eau Claire. Emily Hanna was replaced Leonard Haas, and she had a lot of personal problems with an assistant, the executive assistant. Mm. Who, I don't know what the, I have no verification what the particular problems was, but it was unduly close relationship. He were large salary adjustments. I remember going in and talking to O'Neill. I said, now, is this the right decision? And then I made a mistake. I had good contacts into the state of Minnesota. I could have found out what the problem was, but I didn't do it, and it wasn't long, and then she had to ultimately resign. Mm. She wasn't requested to resign, but she became ineffective at Eau Claire. He pointed Marshall, he must have appointed Horton, who I indicated, did some things to turn Milwaukee around, but I don't think surrounded himself with good people at Milwaukee. He did stir things up over there, which probably was good. I don't think he surrounded himself with as good people as he could have. He didn't. I don't think personnel was his strong suit. He was very articulate, as you notice, and he's very eloquent. And,
he seemed to be rather long-winded for some of the regents' meetings.
Yes, he would talk a lot, yes. But Weaver did that too. Weaver was very vocal. I think O'Neill was more substantive than Weaver was.
You know, it's interesting. You were acting Secretary of the Regents for a while. Weaver's speeches are not given in the Regents' minutes, but O'Neill's are given word for word, even if they go on for several pages, single space.
Well, he really
was that a change in policy?
I wasn't very active as Secretary until after that.
Well, I just meant you would know, you might know why they would change, why the minutes would change.
I don't know. Joe Holt was a longtime secretary and really operated that office with the iron hand. I didn't have any impact on Joe Holt. Then Joe Holt died all of a sudden, and my administrative assistant really was the person who did the work, and she was trained, by a Robert Doyle, who was a public relations person under McPhee, and was trained in how to do these minutes and so forth. And what you see there is not necessarily what was totally said verbatim during that period of time. Because she would make it sound right. In other words, you didn't print it.
She polished the language.
She polished the language up and made it more...
Well, they clearly always do that.
Pardon?
I'm sure they do that all along.
I don't know what the present one does. I was acting secretary mainly because I knew how things operated over there. I was the only one that had experience in that area. And I had the person who worked for me who knew what was going on. As I think I mentioned, she's now the assistant secretary.
Is that Beverly Zimmerman?
No, that's Marlene Elsmo.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, you did mention her name.
Marlene Elsmo, very... capable person who started out on the Madison campus and worked always with some outstanding people, including Pound at Ag School and some of the professor, and then worked at the Central Colony under this person who was so strong in developing the retarded programs, and then worked for McPhee. I think I mentioned to you the problem that we got involved with. They really wanted her as secretary, a lot of the regents, but Arthur DeBartoli made it so difficult. And
I would, this is about my last question, I guess, and you may have some other things to say, but I would like to know what the atmosphere of the system office was as the faculty catch-up plan evolved.
In the system?
I mean, it was a very trying time, and O'Neill was being castigated by various campuses.
Well, now, I retired in May of 85, and that had not had been fully approved.
Well, but it was beginning in,
it was beginning,
in July,
yes,
of 83, when the freeze, Earl had,
yes,
frozen the salaries.
Well, there's, you had in system administration some people who had an extensive experience in this area who were not listened to at all. One was Wally Lemon, who was a very strong person and knows more about statistics and where the University Madison campus stood and so forth. And if and when he retires, there's one person you should talk to. I don't know if he's not particularly one to give a lot of information out. He's rather a quiet person. Was heavily involved in the whole salary program, particularly under O'Neill. Until in the early years of O'Neill, but then he shifted and relied more on Kamek, who did most of the detailed work. I never agreed, and of course there was faction, and I was very quiet on the issue. I had nothing to gain by getting involved. The chancellors were quite upset it was very divisive on the part of the chancellors. I sat in chancellors' meetings with O'Neill, which were really hot.
Were you at that, the Oshkosh meeting?
See, Oshkosh, it's Pinson. Pinson was very strong. Marshall, who was not as effective as Pinson at Stevens Point. George Field up at River Falls, who was very effective, particularly behind the scenes. The chancellor from, I can't remember his name, Eau Claire was quite strong. Those were very difficult times for O'Neill when he pushed that through. I think that they kind of played with figures a little bit.
The system people.
Yes, I think you can do a lot of things with figures, sure. Depending how you can interpret them. I had some discussions with Wally Lemon before I came over, and one thing he says, it's kind of hard for Madison campus to continue to say that they didn't do as well after merger as it did before, when their rank financially has improved substantially nationwide. It's a worthy rank before merger, is worthy rank now in financial support. Hmm. See, it's kind of hard for them to continue to say that's. It was more a device to attempt to get a better, more financial support, wasn't based on fact.
The catch-up plan, you mean?
Well, catch-up plan, but also basically all this talk that you hear about Madison campus not being as well supported. Mm. I think that's more based on rhetoric than on fact, that they actually improve.
And how about the state college, the WSU's?
Why?
Their support.
I don't think it's as strong as it was before merger, because we had a stronger political base then than they did after merger. I think the merger resulted in less influence of the state universities so far as the regents and the administration was concerned politically. And that's the big problem was created in the catch-up, was the strength of those out-state universities politically. They made it very, very rough. And they tied the whole thing up for quite a few years. Yeah. And O'Neill did not have control of those people.
Do you think he should have fired one or two of them?
Well, I don't think he could have. I don't think he could have at that point. They don't really fire many chancellors. It hasn't. Some of them, I think, should be fired. Mm-hmm. They aren't very strong, and they're hurting their institution. But they, it's surprising, they don't fire them. I do think that the present president is responsible for some movement. And one of them, of course, is not Shane. He isn't responsible for there. That's Shane's entire decision. But I think that some others will be going to be asked to leave. I think Shaw looks like the first person who, to me, fits best in the saddle.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I've seen, and I've heard that, and people have said it's too bad that I didn't have a chance to work under him.
He's that much better, is he?
Yes, he just knows how to operate better. Hmm. His decision-making process is better. But now, that could be just still on a honeymoon yet, but everything I hear is good.
He's been there for, a year and a half now?
Yes. And I think you, from what tenor you hear, it's better, don't you?
Mm.
Personally, that's what I hear. I hear that's from people in system administration. that they're, they feel that he's doing some of the right things. Some people are dissatisfied because he doesn't involve as many people in the decision-making process. I think he's providing more effective leadership than we've had since merger. It's always surprising, though, in higher education, and it's, I guess it goes through in public schools. I was a school board member for many, many years, and how things seem to still go on, and it really doesn't have the impact that it appears to have by having a weak administrator. We go in cycles, you know, you have a weak administrator at the top, and it seems people underneath kind of shore that up. They could be at the chancellor's level, or they could be in assistant administration. And it's, the UW system is like an old freight train. It just keeps rolling along, and it's so big that it just, you know, you get something rolling, and it's hard to stop it. Generally, legislatively, I think it has strong support. A lot of the economic development, and people are proud, as well as legislators are proud, of the educational system that we have here in Wisconsin. And they're willing to support it. We believe in education here, and I think it's a good environment. So in spite of all of the quality of administrators that we may not have had, that we had that may not have been as strong as they could, things still keeps rolling along. Because you find very few governors trying to make it tough. I would say Lucy probably was as tough on higher education as any governor has been.
Do you think that if the catch-up plan hadn't been passed and the faculty salaries hadn't gone up at Madison and the exodus had happened, which was predicted, that you could still say that? I mean, do you think that Madison would have suffered?
Well, I don't think they'd have suffered.
You don't think the faculty would have left?
I don't think that that's...
You didn't buy that argument that faculty were being...
People don't move very... They're going to still lose people. They're going to still lose people.
So you don't think Madison's reputation was ever likely to suffer?
I don't think so. You know, look at the research monies that they've gotten even before that, you know. If you follow their grants and so forth, I don't believe that that's the case. Madison has been blessed with some very effective leadership in many of their schools and so forth, in the way that they bring people up. You got to be around for a while before you become effective here. You don't have a person just moving in and moving up. Mm. I think they just, I found that my dealings with the Madison campus, a lot of outstanding people who are committed here to the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, but that's administrators. But I'm speaking about faculty.
I'm speaking of faculty that we deal with when we get involved in programs and so forth.
But I talk to faculty who are, you know, who are really upset, and some of whom were prepared to leave because this was before the catch-up. So it seems to me it was a real threat.
Yeah. But I think they could have gotten the same thing if they'd have been willing to increase fees, because the Madison campus would have benefited most because their cost was highest, and they got more people at the rank of professor and associate professor than is true at these other schools. They'd have gotten more dollars. So I think part of it was the policies of the presidents before that, which helped. Tried to hold down fee increases, which hurt the Madison campus.
Yes, it's persuasive to hear what you say.
Pardon?
I said that's a persuasive argument.
Yes, I think it's more to do with that than anything else. It's hard to get totally state support. I don't know, these faculty are still leaving. You know, here, that's going here and there, and they're outbidding it. Now, Madison campus, I think, has been more careful and not let salaries get too far out of line between people. They tend to bring the whole group up more than, because, well, you probably have heard that from others, that they don't distinguish as much between faculty members as in some schools may do. I know they do give some people increases, but most of the people that come up are, where they do that, are probably underpaid, and they're giving them a promotion. So they tend to bring all of their staff up. I feel that Madison campus has been treated as, well, obviously, if their ranking financially nationwide has improved, they could not have been hurt. I don't know how they can keep claiming they got hurt when they're ranking. Have you heard this from somebody else, that their ranking has improved since merger?
Their ranking?
Nationally, financially.
No.
Well, you can research that out. That's something somebody should research, but it has. And I got that from Wally Lemon. Before he came over, I says, how can they keep saying that when their rank now is better than it was at time of merger?
I will look into it.
What? Relatively, yes. Yeah. And is there anything else that you'd have?
Well, I don't think of anything right now. Did you have any comments? You'd written out some things I noticed in your notes.
I just wanted covered to keep track of who was around when, I have in here only such things as who was governor, and that's really quite important. I think I've also previously indicated the dominant people that I've, since 1950, were E.B. Fred Harvey Harrington, Shane and McPhee, Gene McPhee. Another person who is in the same category, that is Leonard Haas from Eau Claire. I previously indicated the major increase in the operating budget come as a result of faculty and academic staff salary increases. Mm. Regardless, you get more money into it, into the programs in that area. That's where you get your flexibility, also for hiring new people and so forth. It generally ends up that way, right?
Just read this statement cited by the department, the Office of Employment Relations, that flexibility means fat. That's not true, is it?
Well, flexibility comes with more dollars.
Yeah.
You know, you always get, and the chancellor gets control that way too.
Yeah.
The way he allocates that money between the schools, you see, that's really done by the chancellor. The regents don't really get involved in that, and they shouldn't get involved in that. That's entirely a campus decision. Mm-hmm. Well, I think I don't have anything.
Thank you very much for doing this. So, anyway, and you're talking about the